Welcome back to the program. 250 years ago, Alexis de Tocqueville tried to figure out what made America tick. He traveled the country, talked to people, and came away with a pretty good and enduring idea of America's character. In the post-Depression years, Studs Terkel gave us the best picture yet of working men and women. In so doing, he raised oral history to an important and respectable level. He gave people a chance to talk, and he gave all the country a chance to listen and better understand each other. Today it is those who are not working, who are experiencing the real pain of economic dislocation, that we need to better understand in order to better understand each other. Our guest today, D.W. Gibson, has traveled the country to compile and tell these powerful and unifying stories. Stories that are perhaps an antidote to the long tail of technology which is pulling us apart. Perhaps in understanding these stories, it will bring us together. D.W. Gibson has written for the New York Times, Style, and the New York Observer. He's worked on documentaries for A&E Television and MSNBC, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about not working. People talk about losing a job and finding their way in today's changing economy. D.W. Gibson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. First of all, tell us how this project came about. How did you get started on doing this amidst all that we were hearing constantly about unemployment and people losing jobs and the pain and suffering that went along with it?
Yeah, well, I think there were two major components, and the first you've already touched on. I'm a huge admirer of Studs Terkel and his work, and always have been, and I think that I aspire to the kind of stuff he did. And it's sort of with that as a backdrop that I was having a conversation with a very good friend of mine about 2 years ago now, who was telling me the story of the day he lost his job. And we just sort of stumbled upon it in conversation, and before we knew it, he had told me this sort of hour-long version of the story, every single detail. And it had familiar points that you might imagine, you know, a box full of items from the desk and going into the boss's office to get the news. But it was all of the nuance that really brought the story alive. It was the fact that he could pack the box, but he couldn't take the box home. Security had to vet the box and ship it to him. It was the fact that when he went into his boss's office, he ended up comforting his boss, who was having a hard time delivering the bad news. And all of those sort of touches of humanity, and the fact that after he was done telling me this story, we both sort of shared this cathartic feeling, and a light bulb went off in our heads, and he happens to be a book editor, and we thought, you know, there's something to this. There's something about expressing these stories diminishes the sense of isolation that individuals feel when they go through this experience.
The other aspect, and you touched on this a moment ago, is kind of the ritualistic aspect of it, that all of these firings in so many ways involve a kind of kabuki dance that goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's also, too, the fact that this notion of proximity, this notion of the people that very often make the decision are not the individual delivering the news, and that affects the situation. And also, too, the fact that it's so hard, even for folks that have loved ones around them that are there to nurture them and care for them, it's always about sort of moving past this, you know, getting past it. And a lot of times I think we sort of skip over that confrontation, that expression of what actually happened.
The other aspect of it is the degree to which this is not just about the economic dislocation. We think of people being unemployed, and we certainly think of the economic consequences of it, but the psychological and social consequences, as particularly as these people tell these stories, is so much greater.
It is, and it's, I mean, that's a tricky statement to say because, you know, say that to the person looking for money for dinner. I mean, certainly money is central, but the fact is, at the end of the day, when you lose your job, it's so much more about a loss of identity. And the aftermath is about reassembling dignity and getting to a place where you feel like you're contributing. I mean, it's that the notion of getting up in the morning and putting on your clothes and you don't have any place to go. Even people who lost jobs that they, you know, said they weren't, you know, that happy in, or wasn't that fulfilling. But when it's removed, when it's taken out from under them, they feel lost. They don't have a routine, and they don't have a sense of identity. I mean, consider the fact that in the 12th century, we started taking the name of our labor. You know, weaver, cook, baker. It's central to who we are.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how you set about finding the people that you did. You went on this cross-country journey, and you started with cities with some of the highest foreclosure rates.
Indeed, yeah. I it was very tricky mapping a path across the country and wanting to make sure we hit as many diverse places as we could. And I was traveling with a couple of collaborators, and that was essential because when I wasn't interviewing someone, we were constantly looking for more people to interview, and it was using every tool we could possibly think to use. I mean, we were standing outside of unemployment offices. We were in church every Sunday. We were at soup kitchens. We were talking to local beat reporters at newspapers that had covered, layoffs and plant closures. We were contacting those friends of Facebook friends, anything we could think of. And there was also this wonderful sort of winding trail of one person leading to another. We would speak to someone in Reno who knew, had a friend that had relocated to Omaha and said, look, when you get there, make sure you look them up. And that was wonderful, too, because there was a certain thread there that ran throughout.
And you put this on film for a documentary that you're making.
Yes. I knew that I would be recording the conversations because, in fact, it is an oral history project, and the chapters are, by and large, assembled from the words of the folks I spoke with. And I knew that if I was going to be doing that, then there would be an opportunity to engage some folks on camera. And of course, some people aren't comfortable with that, and that was something we had to sort of feel out as we got to know each other in short order. But when people were comfortable talking in front of the camera, we did do that. And I have to say, we're working on that documentary now, and we're just about to wrap up, and hopefully we'll have that out into the world this fall. But there's something that happens with that aspect of the project, because when you see someone going through the process of telling the story of the day they lost their job, there are those moments where on the page it's sort of an unbroken, it's a broken sentence, but with the camera there, it's all about all of the emotion, all the stuff that rises to the surface, and you really see and feel how the person is affected.
There's the sense that in many cases people hadn't really told this story before, that they hadn't had the opportunity, even within the context of their own friends and family, to really express the raw emotion of what happened.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, a woman in Irvine, California, who had worked for a bank and worked in HR, and as she put it, her job was making bad news sound like good news, candy coating things for the corporation. And she was laid off after 20 years, over 20 years, through not an email, but an email attachment. There was not even a body to the email. And, talk about sort of flying in the face of the good work she had been doing for so long. By laying her off in such a fashion, the company essentially said, all of that work you've been doing for us, all the candy coating, all the eloquence, it doesn't really matter. And that was sort of a double whammy for her. It really cut to the core of what she thought was important about what she was doing. And she said point blank that you're the first person I've told this story to, because all of the people around me that love me and care for me, immediately they gave me a hug and they said, let's move past this. And it was when she told the story that she realized that that was an essential part of the process of healing.
In many cases, it is a little like mourning or grieving, that you really have to be able to tell the story. You have to move on to that next phase.
Yes, and those are two words that popped up for sure. I think of two journalists in Indianapolis that worked for a paper there, and they were laid off definitely in a changing profession, to say the least. And they spoke about that loss of routine, sitting at home. I spoke to two of them in a sort of a shared interview, and one of them says, I can't sleep. The other one says, I'm sleeping too much. And they're sort of working through this as they speak about it, and they arrived at that word. They said, this is mourning. We're grieving.
Was there a greater sense of shared participation in something because they all knew that, particularly in this period, 2007 through 2011, that this was happening everywhere?
Well, some people had that awareness, but a lot didn't. And I think that that's my greatest hope for this project, because I think the unemployment rate number that we use, the 8.2%, the 8.3%, it does a disservice to us because it's completely inaccurate. I mean, it leaves out folks that are discouraged and have stopped working. It leaves out people that have, working 10 hours a week just to bring in some income. It leaves out the underemployed. If you cobble together all of these categories of people affected by unemployment, clearly that number grows and grows dramatically. And I think that's hard to face, but it's also helpful to face because it does address that feeling of isolation. I think of a draftsman in West Des Moines, Iowa, who said, And he had to take three jobs after he lost his job. He started delivering at 54 years old, started delivering newspapers at 2:30 in the morning. He was working at a hardware store, and then he was working at a grocery store. And he would see people at those different venues, and they would say, wait a second, weren't you just at the hardware store? Weren't you just at the grocery store? And he would have to explain. And then people started coming in and telling him their story when they lost their job. And he said, you know, it doesn't make me feel good hearing that, but it makes me feel better knowing that I'm not in the boat rowing all alone. And I think that that's really the essence of this project, and I hope what can come of it, that feeling of community.
The other sense of community, particularly in small-town America, is the story that you tell, and I forget the name of the gentleman, the tool plant that shuts down in Nebraska, where basically the whole town shuts down.
Yeah, DeWitt, Nebraska, a town of 572 people. And I spoke to Randy Badman, who is just a sensational individual. And he worked there for 36 years. His grandfather worked there. His uncles worked there. His parents worked there. Everybody worked there. And he was laid off in 2008. And he received a security escort out of the facilities after 36 years. You know, that company was owned by a family that actually patented the vice grip tool. And they manufactured it there for 84 years. And at one point, the family sold the company to a larger corporation. And it was there that you see the breakdown. Because when the family, when the Peterson family was running that plant, yes, they made hard decisions and they affected DeWitt. But the Peterson family walked those streets. You know, they saw the people they affected. And when you remove that proximity, it makes it a lot easier to make hurtful decisions that affect a lot of people's lives. And DeWitt, indeed, I mean, it's been hollowed out. That plant sits there empty in the middle of this small town. You go by it every day, and they can't keep a grocery store open. So you see all of these amenities that are diminished for the people that live there, and you see the full breadth of the effect of unemployment.
And that's one of those classic examples where people realize that they're never going to recreate what they had before.
Yes. And that is a painful realization, especially if you are on that side of a career or you are in the thriving right in the middle of a career. And that sense of redirecting your life it can be a daunting task. And I think that's a key point to this period of time in particular, because, you know, a lot of jobs are changing altogether. I mean, again, the draftsmen, you know, architects and engineers, they're now using computer-aided design to do that work. And journalists, I mean, there are all kinds of professions that are changing dramatically. And so we're at a crucial point here where a lot of adaptability is required of us, and it's a huge challenge.
It's interesting that there are those people that you come across, and there are those people out there, that are pretty good at reinventing themselves and that just move on to whatever the next step is and they figure out a way. And there are those that are not very good at it. What do you think, from the interviews that you conducted, the people that you talked to, what separates those that move forward versus those that get stuck?
That's a great question. It's actually been on my mind the last few days because I was just in St. Louis doing an event with a woman from the book named Ronnie Chambers, who's tremendous. She worked in HR and had to lay off, by her estimation, 200 people in one day, and then she herself was laid off. And she has reinvented herself, and she's running a networking club there in St. Louis and doing a really good job of it, helping people that are, you know, looking for a place to land. And, you know, she made a comment to me that someone who's been out of work for a long period of time, a couple of years, it's for a reason. And I said, Ronnie, what do you mean by that? And she said, they're holding on to something. And I think that's true. It's really hard to let go of a bitterness, of an anger, of a disappointment. And I think letting go of those feelings and those emotions is key to moving on. And indeed, you know, something that a lot of folks struggle with, and those who struggle with it are the ones that have a hard time reinventing themselves.
The other part of it is that it's so caught up in whatever the hopes and dreams and plans that these people had that literally end and or change in an instant.
Yes, yes. Pictures you had of your life, you know, we all envision what next year looks like, what the next 10 years look like, and what our lives look like. And that's really hard. You know, age never really seems to be a positive factor. If you're 22, you feel like, you know, you don't have the resume and everyone tells you you don't have the experience. And if you're 55, you feel like everyone tells you that they're looking for someone younger and cheaper. And in some cases, you know, both are true. And I think for people in the latter group that have had longer careers, they were cut short. There are no words really to console them in those cases. They weren't allowed to finish what they were crafting as their own version of their own, you know, American dream, and I think, which was in most cases extremely humble. It really relates back to just simply having your own home, having benefits, and having some quality of life. And a lot of people have been forced to come to the realization that it just is not going to work out like they hoped it would.
As a result of that, talk about the anger and the bitterness that you did encounter out there.
Yeah, you know, the word bitter comes up a lot. And again, people just find different ways to manage that and to varying degrees of success. And I think overcoming that is a huge part of the process. And people direct that anger in all different places. I mean, they sometimes it's directed at people who've made the decision, the company they work for. And in some cases, it's directed at politics. But I have to say, too, when it's directed at politics and political leadership, it never was expressed to me, or I should say very, very rarely expressed to me, as anger at a political party. It really was anger at political leadership across the spectrum. And this idea, this feeling that capitalism was being prioritized over democracy, and that shareholders were being prioritized over employees. And of course, one cannot have a business without shareholders financing, but also one cannot have a business without employees to actually do the work. And I think there was a lot of anger and bitterness when people expressed that they didn't feel that those priorities were being measured correctly.
Was there a sense of people blaming themselves in some cases?
Yes. I mean, Wendy Hamilton, who opens the book, when I talked to her, 32-year-old, you know, should be at the outset of a career. She has a master's degree. She's clearly a professional through and through. And she talked so well about that. You know, one word that a lot of people avoid is the word shame, but she used it. And she said, you know, I knew that they weren't letting me go because of performance. I knew that, but it doesn't matter. She said, it doesn't matter what class you're from, what background you're from. At one point, it will get in your head, and you will say, it's my fault. And I think that that's true. People, there's this dichotomous. There's a part of, you know, your brain says, okay, I understand. But your being, yourself says, you know, what could I have done? Why did they pick me? Why did they pick me?
And that really has to do with a much larger discussion, a larger social construct that we have about work and about employment and why we react the way we do.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it goes back to the fact that work is essential to who we are. You know, I ended every single conversation by asking the person I was speaking with to tell me what the definition of work is. And I have to say, it was very rare when that answer had anything to do with a sense of money or paycheck. I mean, certainly that came up. But most of the time, it was about, well, work is responsibility. Work is identity. And, you know, that's central for who we are. And so that really paints the stakes for us.
What's interesting, too, is a sense in a lot of these people, a sense of denial that it was going to happen to them. You know, there's the old saw that a recession is when your neighbor loses their job, a depression is when you lose your job. And there was that sense in many cases of people thinking this wasn't going to happen to them.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think it works both ways. There are some folks that saw it coming down the pike, and they talk about walking on eggshells for weeks or months even, just waiting for it to happen. And then there are those who are completely blindsided. I mean, a gentleman in Columbus, Ohio, who worked for a construction company, was a manager on jobs, and a very small company, and he walks in one day, opens the door, and the entire office has been cleared out over the weekend. I mean, all the desks, everything, gone. And, you know, when that happens, it's numb. There's, you know, how do you react to something like that? And so there you have not only the task of dealing with it, but there's that initial shock that's really just a visceral reaction.
Among those people, and there were a few that didn't really like the jobs they were in any case, was there a sense of, well, this is for the best and it will provide some opportunity to move forward?
Well, there's certainly you know, optimism there that you can see in people that they can take it as an opportunity to do something better. But the funny thing is that people who lose jobs that they clearly didn't even enjoy, there's still anguish there because it's that psychological effect of feeling like you weren't wanted, even if that wasn't necessarily the case. But yes, absolutely, there are people that reinvent themselves, and I think that, you know, when I sat down to actually put the book together, it felt like it was sort of this epic battle between two forces, and one of them is these terrible stories, these terrible circumstances. But the other force is character, will, determination. And I'm happy to say that so often that the character of the person telling a terrible story trumped the terrible story. And I found that very inspiring.
Talk a little bit about that sense of optimism, the feeling that, in fact, these people will, some of them feel that they will absolutely persevere.
The people who I met who expressed and demonstrated optimism were the people I think that were able to, instead of sort of banging their head against the wall and saying, okay, I was making $75,000 and this was the slot that I fit into, how can I find that slot again? They sort of backed up and they said, okay, what's the fat in my life? What can I trim out? How can I live more frugally? How can I improve my quality of life for less money? And when they do that, it's usually followed by a winding path of exploration of other things they enjoy doing. And I think of Nancy Lee in Indianapolis, who did just as I described. She really sort of took that step back and started living a much more frugal and really happy life, rediscovered her love for jewelry making and started making jewelry, and got into metalsmithing and is really making quite accomplished pieces now and selling them and having success financially, yes, but more to the point, she's happy. She's doing work she really enjoys.
Be interesting to go back and look at all of these people 10 years from now.
Absolutely, positively.
D.W. Gibson, his book is Not Working. People talk about losing a job and finding their way in today's changing economy. D.W., I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.